Hello, listeners of the Practical Democracy podcast. It's your host, Ben, again. I'm coming to you from isolation with a bit of a special episode. About a month ago, I interviewed the brilliant sociologist, Dr. Nicole Curato, who's based at the Centre for Deliberative Democracy and Global Governance at the University of Canberra. I was really keen to set up the podcast, so I just read her new book, Democracy in a Time of Misery, From Spectacular Tragedies to Deliberative Action, which we discussed at length. Since our chat, a lot has changed with the world, but if anything, the content has never been more relevant, so I'd really recommend giving it a listen. Enjoy.
What's your job title, Nicole?
So technically, I'm an associate professor at the Centre for Deliberative Democracy and Global Governance at the University of Canberra.
Wow. Okay, that's a great job title. Really good. And why do you say technically?
Just because that's what appears on my payslip. But I'd like to kind of just, describe my profession as I'm a sociologist. I try to study how social realities unfold. I'm more comfortable with that title.
Okay. Oh, well, that's good. That's a very very interesting place to begin. And so, just to take a step back, because we are here to talk about the book you've written, Democracy in a Time of Misery, which is obviously a brilliant title, and we will get into the kind of depth of it. But as with all of these things, it's always good for the listeners to learn a bit about you, I suppose, before we move on to all the kind of interesting things you've done. So you've mentioned your job title and how you actually kind of view yourself and your profession and your work and so on. How did this all come about? Like, where are you from originally? Where did your interest come in this? And maybe could you give us a flavor of what you've done in academia up to this point, if that's
right.
Okay.
Yeah, so actually all my degrees are in sociology from the university days up to my PhD. But I think that was kind of by accident. Academia was an accident, but I don't think any 16-year-old kid would dream to become an academic, right? But I think, just in terms of where I was born and raised, I was born and raised in the Philippines, but I've spent my adult life living elsewhere in the US, in the UK, and now Australia. And the work that I do now has a lot to do with politics and how communities perform democracies in their everyday lives. But when I kind of look back on my childhood, I was raised in a fairly apolitical household, although I grew up reading Time magazine and watching American cable news with my father. So there's definitely this background of understanding or being curious about politics, but living in a nonpartisan apolitical household. But then when I studied sociology in uni, I think that's when I started getting more interested in being more systematic and challenging our taken for granted assumptions. And I think that kind of set the agenda for the rest of my professional career.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. Well, that's a great start and super interesting, especially because sometimes people work in this field. Maybe they've grown up in a certain household and had a certain type of experience, and you can really understand why they do it for a living. And actually, some of the more interesting people are maybe people who haven't come to it through that route. So you mentioned just there initially around like institutions and challenging and all these kind of things. Was there something specific that kind of happened or a realization that you had that you thought, actually, this is something I want to pursue? Or was it more just sort of a general awakening or an awareness, if you see what I mean?
Like what I said, I've always been interested about politics, but not really kind of interested in changing the way things are. So I think there's that big distinction of seeing myself as someone who interprets what's going on with the world versus being someone who actually wants to contribute something to change the world. And I think my biggest political awakening was when I was an undergraduate student and I was in the Philippines then. One of my classmates was abducted by the military when she was working with the peasant movement. And to me, that's really formative of my political awareness. She's an activist. She really is committed to kind of a more left-wing agenda, which I think if you're kind of 18-year-old, just read Marx, is very admirable. It's one thing to read Marx, but to actually act on it is a different thing. So when that happened to her, it really kind of made me think, you can't just study. There has to be something else that you put on offer. But my skills have to be commensurate to the kind of tasks that I should be able to do. Like, I'd be a bad activist. I'd be a bad community organizer. I just don't have the energy and the social skills for it. But what am I good at? I think I'm good at researching. I think I'm good at getting information. I think I'm good at writing and telling other people's stories in a systematic manner. So I think that's how I think I ended up doing the research that I do.
Yeah, Why? Okay, that's yeah, I mean that's fascinating and really obviously quite a powerful motivation for doing it. And it's interesting that you know you have this drive to make a change and this is the path you've kind of pursued. I mean that's fascinating. And what did you study just in you know basic academic terms? You mentioned you see yourself more as maybe a social science scientist, but yeah, could you give people a flavour of that kind of thing and maybe what this research became, you know, once you'd had this realization that was the path you were going to take. If sounds all a bit cheesy, doesn't it, the way I've posed that question? But yeah, I don't know. You just give us an idea, maybe.
Yeah. So yeah, all my degrees are in sociology. So I did my bachelor's in the Philippines. I studied sociology in Manchester, actually, for my master's, and then I moved to Birmingham for my PhD. And I read sociology all the way. But I think what's Yeah, that's right. So yeah, all of my training with winter and alcohol is really just from Manchester. So I will never forget that. These are like good life skills. But yeah, so but I think what kind of set my research trajectory apart is that I feel like I have to be in the field to understand something. I have some colleagues who are so good with numbers, who are so good with surveys and statistics and multi-level modeling, which are very powerful tools, especially now that big data is available. So that's important. But for me, that's not what I'm good at. That's not what makes or brings meaning to my work. So I think the kind of sociology that I do is what I call embedded sociology. I really want to experience with my respondents' experience to get a sense of what's going on. But also I would describe it as engaged sociology, meaning a kind of sociology that doesn't just speak among academic audiences, although I enjoy that a lot as well, but the kind of sociology that tries to have a conversation with the broader public. And I deliberately use the term broader conversation and not dissemination of research findings, because it feels like if I disseminate my research findings, it's a one-way thing. I don't think that's the case. I think my research, the work that I do, is an invitation for a conversation for me to also learn from the public. So I think that's how I locate my work.
Okay, well that's great, and it's nice to hear you. I suppose you're living your principles of your research, right? Very much a two-way conversation around this stuff. And it also strikes me as well that almost seems like, I don't know if this is incorrect, though, but a kind of a grassroots approach to research as opposed to almost an approach seeking to maybe validate some predetermined theories. I mean, is that fair to say? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I do a lot of media work in the Philippines. I write some op-eds for mainstream international publications. But what I really enjoy in terms of public sociology or engaged sociology is staying in touch and communicating with the people that I work with in my research. So, for example, for this book, I've done several book launches in several countries and universities. But what's really exciting for me is that I was able to organize book launches in Southern Philippines, where the students were really asking really tough questions because it's their life that I'm talking about. Or a couple of weeks from now, I'm actually going back to Tacloban, the ground zero of the disaster where I did my research, and actually talk to the communities and give them like a shortened version of the book for them to criticize, engage, and question. So yeah, I really like that kind of, yeah. So that's the kind of engagement that I think makes this kind of career meaningful.
Why? Wow, okay, cool. So I had no idea about any of this. All I'd seen is you know, is this book, the book that you've written, the latest book you've written, I should say, and we'll talk about that in just a second. But that's really refreshing to hear, because I do think sometimes academia can be off in its own world. You know, I think that's true of lots of aspects of academia. But it also, I think one of the issues I've seen in this particular field of academia is that it lags behind the real world, particularly when the things like the internet and things like that. So often the thinking you see presented, I often think, well, that's kind of demonstrably incorrect. You know, it might be like empirically correct somehow, but actually the world's moved on. So I think that's amazing that you do so much engagement around it. So we should talk about the book itself. From the title, what is the full title of the book? So it's Democracy in the Time of Misery, and then what is it? From Something to Something to Something. What was the final part?
After Tragedies to Deliberative Action.
Yeah, which is a great title. And sorry, I should have had that written down next to me.
That's okay.
terrible interviewing. But anyway, chance to hear more from you, which is what we're here for. And the first thing, actually, when I saw it kind of float across my Twitter feed was like, that is a brilliantly flippant reference to, you know, Brexit and Trump or climate change or the mess that you could say a lot of like Western politics is in. But actually it isn't. And we've had a little oblique reference to it. But could you explain to us kind of like maybe just give us a short summary of the book, naturally where the research is situated and kind of some of the prompts around it?
Yeah, I mean, you can say that. The book is indeed a good reference to what's going on in many parts of the world. But the book is based on a specific tragedy, which is the experience of poor communities who suffered in the aftermath of Typhoon Haiyan. Typhoon Haiyan is one of the strongest storms that made landfall in recent history. I could give you statistics, but my favorite description is it makes Hurricane Katrina a run-of-the-mill storm, according to one meteorologist, just to put things in context. And it's really like 6,000 people died, but that's not even the accurate count yet, according to many of my networks. But the book is not just about that. I think more broadly, it's about the experience of communities in the aftermath of a traumatic event, an event that took away not only their material possessions, but also their confidence to take charge of their lives. So I think if we read the book from that perspective, of that the book is about people trying to create the rudiments of democracy on the fly, people who are in the aftermath of a disaster, not only feeling disrupted, but their everyday life is ruptured, not just disrupted, but ruptured, and faced with a challenge of how to make sense of the world. But then I think the book speaks to people who feel destabilized after Brexit or who feel destabilized after America voted for a morally reprehensible man to occupy the White House. I mean, I think the bigger question the book asks is how can we reconstruct democracy at a time when nothing is promised? How does that look like?
Yeah. And you say some really, really interesting things about it. And I think not to move on too quickly, but, you know, the idea of this misery concept, this isn't just a flippant title, right? I mean, naturally, there is misery after natural disaster. That's kind of implicit. But actually, you define misery early on. And I thought some of the things that you wrote were powerful. Also, some of the more soundbitey ways that you frame things are just excellent. So if people do end up reading the book or buying the book or something, you'll get quite a lot out of it in that respect. But so one thing,
otherwise I can give them Instagram quotes.
Okay, all right, fine. That's very generous of you. But you say in your introduction, this book looks at misery as both a productive and corrosive democratic force, which is just one of the kind of interesting things that you say. You also say there is power in surviving tragic moments, power in that act, which is not something I thought about as a consequence of disaster, you know, empowerment. And you also say that misery provides effective foundations for democratic politics to take root. So, you know, just the introduction, when I was going through, I was like, bloody hell, there's some kind of big ideas in this. But could you give us maybe, a definition of misery? Because it really is central. And you do also talk about the individual, collective and political experience of misery. So, yeah, I don't know. It's so central to the book. And obviously, we do want to talk about that specifically. So, yeah, I don't know. Could you talk to me about misery, if that's okay?
Yeah, I think, when I wrote the book, or when I started writing the book, it wasn't designed to really be about misery. My motivation, actually, for writing the book when I first entered on the field was to understand how participatory governance unfolds in the aftermath of disasters. It was a straightforward research question. Like, I just really wanted to know what mechanisms there are for citizens to participate in post-disaster rehabilitation. It sounds so simple, right? So I was ready to just conduct interviews and observe how political participation, especially among most vulnerable communities, what avenues are present for them to kind of give feedback, get accountability, when they engage with the state. But then when I started looking at my transcripts and the longer I stay in the field, I think it's just so obvious that misery or suffering, terms I use interchangeably in the book, it's just obvious that it's present. I mean, when I go to the field, I see makeshift graves in highways. I see signs outside makeshift homes that commemorate the lives of people who died in the disaster. So I think this is one of the advantages of being embedded in the field, because what is obvious can be problematized. We can start asking, why is this obvious? Why is this taken for granted? When my respondents often tell me we're miserable, miserable in their language. I just can't ignore that. I can't just take that as a background context and assume that, okay, they're sad. How do they take part in politics? So the book kind of took a different direction and I tried to understand how exactly is this taken for granted reality of people feeling miserable? How is this affecting the way they engage in politics? And so in the book, there are different layers of misery that I kind of unpacked. So of course, on the most basic individual level, psychologists would say that misery is like a negatively valenced emotion. Like it's an individual experience, especially when we don't communicate our misery to others. In I think one of the first few chapters, I was talking about how people who are suffering, especially from health issues like cancer or some other form of terminal illness, they feel like their silence, not talking about their misery, is a way of honoring their misery, because talking about your suffering kind of cheapens the experience. So misery can be an individual experience. What I also explain in the book is that misery can be a collective experience. So for example, I mentioned earlier collective practices of mourning. So we can think about commemoration of the disaster in the mass grave, or candlelighting vigils to pray for the soul of the dead. So it's very social. Performing misery is a social event as well. But I think what the book offers is that actually misery can also be political. Misery can be transformed to political claims and political demands. So when disaster survivor groups call for government accountability for deaths that could have been avoided had there been better weather forecasting, or when disaster survivors contest the official death toll of 6,000 and accuse the government of sanitizing the data, then I think that's a political claim. It's using their suffering, it's using mourning, it's using their grief to hold the government accountable. And I think that's what's making this kind of political moment very powerful, because misery is transformed not just as an individual to a collective experience, but from a collective to a political experience.
Yeah, crikey. That's just a really, really good answer and really in-depth. And naturally, what you're pulling out there is a force that I don't suppose people generally stop to consider, let alone define, let alone codify and start to think about how that impacts on accountability and so on. Naturally, more of which later. Okay, so that's super interesting. And so I think the way that you described it, you had a really good phrase, that the way that you kind of fell upon this idea of misery was through ethnographic serendipity, which I thought was just a...
That's romantic, really, right?
Yeah, that was just a lovely bit of language. Finding something that is unsought, in this case, misery. Okay, great. And so just so we can situate this for people listening who might not be familiar with what happened exactly and indeed the response, because I think that really kind of like neatly moves us on to what you actually kind of researched, the nuts and bolts, if you will. So there was a tropical cyclone. You mentioned, you know, a lot of people killed and that death toll is indeed contested. And this was in 2013, so quite a while ago. And the part most affected was Tacloban City, assuming I'm pronouncing that correctly, which may not be. Yeah, okay, cool. And there was a 23-foot storm surge and there was lots of villages destroyed and so on and so forth. So this is very much what we would consider in just in the West, maybe through my own lens, like a traditional large-scale natural disaster, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And in response to that, there was a traditional international response to it. And I read up a bit, and this really isn't my kind of world, so I found it quite interesting that Bill Clinton was quite involved with increasing levels of community participation in disaster recovery, if that's the right term. Is that correct? And that led to a kind of this, so you say, mandate that the people affected, or citizens, or however you define victims possibly, you know, they were kind of supposed to be empowered to be able to recreate their community and so on, right? And actually, this in this particular case, this kind of manifested itself in quite a specific way. So One thing I was really hoping to hear from you about, and as always, that was a terribly framed question. If you could hear it under there, I'm not actually very good at interviewing people. But in the response to the Philippines, building on this idea of kind of, you know, people at the heart of recovery and so on and so forth,
right.
You know, people saw the Philippines as what you describe as an ideal laboratory. And that was because of some fairly unique circumstances. So I believe there's a high amount of smartphone usage and internet coverage. Is that correct?
Yeah, or... that's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. And so anyway, what comes out of this was this SMS response line. And then you notice this kind of impact, this idea around the ideal victim or ideal victimhood. So I was really hoping to maybe unpack, you know, your views on the current approach, the standard approach to this, you know, disaster recovery. And then, you know, talk us through this SMS response line and everything else that kind of came as a result.
The Clinton agenda you mentioned, they call it the Building Back Better agenda. And the idea there is that for communities to build back better, communities should be the one driving their own recovery. And so there are two ways of interpreting that, right? One is to say, okay, this is good. This is a space for participatory programs for communities to be able to collaborate with humanitarian organizations in the state to rebuild and put their interests at the center of rebuilding process. Others are also saying, however, that actually this is just taking responsibilities away from the state and making communities in charge of their own recovery. So there are two different schools of thought when it comes to that. But what's interesting about the Philippines is that, as you mentioned, a lot of humanitarian organizations considered it as an ideal laboratory to test some of these mechanisms of putting citizens at the center of the post-disaster rehabilitation agenda. And that took the form of, I think, one of the slogans or principles, it's not fair to call it a slogan, but one of the principles that humanitarian organizations use now is communication is aid. And one of the ways to enhance communication in the aftermath of a disaster is to use digital technologies. And I think today, in 2020, it's not peculiar anymore for vulnerable communities to consider digital technology as one of their most immediate needs after a disaster. So a smartphone is a lifeline, right? So whether we are talking about a Syrian refugee in Canada or a fisherman who lost his boat in Sri Lanka after a tsunami, a smartphone is a lifeline. It's not a luxury. It's a necessity. So
absolutely. In the UK, we have a massive homelessness problem, which might be our equivalent. And, you know, smartphones, it's talked about a lot, are their, you know, the most useful object, the most primary way they can access the world and everything else. And like, yeah, it's kind of peculiar, I suppose. So that's, you know, you see that all across the world. Or maybe it's not peculiar. Maybe that's just the age we live in, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, internet connection is considered a human right now, right? So it's not very, it's not very peculiar. So I think what that does is there's now a recognition that voice is a crucial part of aid and recovery. So how is this operationalized in practice in the Philippines? Well, in the Philippines, this took the form of using mobile phone technologies as a way of communicating with disaster-affected communities to find out what they need and to get feedback with disaster response. So here's a trivia about the Philippines. It's called the social media capital of the world. It's called the selfie capital of the world. So there's a Time magazine article that actually mapped the density of selfies being taken in Instagram around the world. And voila, ground zero is the Philippines. But actually, yeah, it's interesting because it may sound quite shallow that, okay, why are there so many selfies happening? Why do Filipinos spend the most time on Facebook? And the reason for that is because the Philippines has a huge diasporic community. So anywhere you go in the world, there's a Filipino working there, whether it's a cruise ship or a nurse in the NHS or in a hotel in Djibouti, right? There will always be a Filipino there. 10% of the population are foreign migrant workers, which makes mobile phones, social media, and selfies a central part of how it is to be a Filipino family these days. So this is what makes the Philippines an ideal laboratory to experiment on digital technologies in the aftermath of a disaster, because it's not an alien mechanism for voice and feedback. It's a mechanism that's enveloped in Filipinos' everyday lives. So, so what happened then in the disaster? Well, humanitarian organizations considered mobile phone, especially text hotlines, to be the main channel for voice. And listening was actually operationalized with local aid workers cataloging the text messages they received, and then they report these text messages to the headquarters, whether it's Geneva or New York or wherever the humanitarian organization is based. So in a separate project I worked with colleagues in the UK, we actually found that text hotlines using digital technologies or mobile phone technologies as the main avenue to use to communicate with disaster survivors is actually quite problematic. Because when we analyzed what's being texted, we realized that feedback or accountability actually worked in the Filipino context. And I'm doing air quotes here about the Filipino context. So we found messages of gratitude as the most popular text message sent, like, thank you, Oxfam, thank you, UNICEF, thank you, UNHCR, for being here. Of course, in the first few days of the disasters, it's like, help us, we need food, or help us, we need water. Yeah. So that was common in the first few days of the disasters. But eventually, there are a lot of thank you text messages. Outside text messaging, this is my favorite example. There are gardens created by disaster affected communities thanking humanitarian organizations for helping them rebuild their houses. I mean, it's super touching, right? And I think this is where my colleague calls this kind of practice as ideal victimhood. The ideal victim is grateful. The ideal victim does not just complain. The ideal victim is deserving. And one of the favorite examples that I have is that after this typhoon, there's this huge advertisement in Piccadilly Circus that says, the Philippines says thank you. Because, you know, Jamie Oliver did a fundraising, One Direction did fundraising. So thank you, UK. We are deserving victims. So I think that's the message that the book also kind of communicates, that sometimes good intentions, for example, using mobile phone technologies, ways of communicating that are familiar to disaster-affected communities, maybe that looks effective, but we also have to look at the cultural context of what's being texted, right? Like, imagine texting your mom, with your mom asking you, how are you doing? Of course you say, yeah, I'm all right, right? So there's something lost in translation there. So I think, that's one of the key messages, that if we just focus on the digital, we don't get the full picture. We get a partial picture of what it is to be a disaster survivor.
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating. It's fascinating. And I suppose it speaks of quite literally the value of research, right? Because on a facile level, you know, as you've described, everyone uses mobile phones and the internet, and it's, you know, really part of the culture. So you just think, well, obviously that's the way to go. But then, you know, it's always that thing that you have technology and an idea, and then human beings get involved, right? but what were some of the problems, aside from people just saying thanks, you know? I think you've kind of sort of referred to it, but what were some of the problems about people who maybe didn't use the line, or, you know? Yeah, I don't know if you could talk us through that, because I would like to get into some of the other themes in the book. But yeah, what were some of the specific problems with it, apart from maybe giving off the wrong impression and being used incorrectly in that basic sense?
Yeah, I think, the other problem with digital technologies is that it kind of structures the way people communicate already. So if we look at Facebook at that time didn't have all the emojis yet, it just had the like button, right? So what goes viral are positive stories because you like positive stories, whereas negative stories are also not going viral. And typically negative stories are the stories that demand attention, like people are not getting aid or local officials are being corrupt about the aid given to that's supposed to go to the communities. So that's actually one of the problems as well. And then one chapter in the book actually talks about how discussions, public conversations taking place on Twitter in the aftermath of the disaster, again, tries to have these conversations conform to the norms expected in the aftermath of a disaster. So in the first 100 days of the disaster, I tracked these tweets, which is quite enjoyable. And most of the tweets that trended are from celebrities, from Harry Styles, from Pope Francis, from Barack Obama, from, I can't remember, but it's a K-pop star. I should know this. I'm so embarrassed. My pop culture credentials are being challenged right now. But anyway, so all of these kind of popular celebrities are calling for compassion and aid for these communities. Whereas those on Twitter who kind of say, oh, hang on a minute, isn't this a problem of climate change? Isn't there a climate change summit or climate summit happening in, was it Copenhagen? I can't really remember. shouldn't we demand for climate justice? Those people who say that are just criticized and said, we haven't even buried the dead yet. You're talking about climate change already. How dare you? That's so inappropriate. So I think that's also one of the limitations of engaging these conversations online, that you get the critical voices are just shouted down by the more dominant voices, which just demands compassion. So it's kind of interesting because, of course, compassion seems benign, right? Who doesn't want compassion? But sometimes focusing on compassion has costs.
Yeah. Well, again, that's a lovely little soundbite there. Compassion, you know, we assume is benign, right? And actually, you know, your book talks about how that often isn't the case. Also, you've just explained. So would you the kind of group you've just talked about, because I'm quite interested in the idea of publics, because this is something that the book talks about a lot. So would you call that a surrogate public, if I understood that correctly, or if I, you know, right, or would that be an example of a surrogate public?
Yes, you're right. That is a surrogate public. And the organizing principle of the book actually is to describe the different kinds of publics that emerged after the disaster. And I use the term publics with a plural form purposively, because I recognize that there's a fragmentation of views. Like, you can be one person in a public, but espouse different views. So you don't just belong to one public. You can belong to many different publics, because you take part in different forms of these discourses. And my argument here is that when we talk about disaster survivors, they're not just people with a single interest. They themselves have competing interests. They themselves have disagreements with each other. They're political agents with different aspirations and contrasting views on how the future should look like. So I think by thinking about how publics are constructed, in the book I was looking at how these publics articulate, perform, contest their views, as well as how their views are silenced and judged by different people in the public sphere. So when you mentioned surrogate publics, that's really just an example of people online, mostly, who try to, they're self-appointed, like they assign themselves the role of speaking on behalf of disaster survivors who cannot speak for themselves. And so, they try to represent the views of people that they may not have even met yet, but they're trying to act as surrogates to give voice for those who cannot speak themselves.
Yeah. Which, you know, again, is kind of fascinating and definitely something that I think we've all seen and experienced. But, I haven't kind of looked at it through the lens of your research, I suppose. So it's quite a powerful bit of insight, really, and quite a neat definition as well, actually. So with this podcast series, we're trying to spread this kind of just interesting, whether it's, you know, just research or life experience or whatever, with quite a broad audience. So on that note, like, for anyone who's you know, more of a generalist, shall we say, what do you mean by public or publics? Could you just give us a little kind of definition before maybe we explore a few more of them?
Yeah, so my academic definition of it draws from Nancy Fraser, which kind of discusses publics as an arena for the production and circulation of discourses. So in a way, publics are not tied to headcounts. The publics refer to a space where ideas and counter arguments are developed. So it's a bit abstract, but I hope the chapters kind of bring to life what these arenas for the creation of discourses look like. So yeah, there are many different publics that I explained in the book. But I think what's very special with this research was that I just did not assume that a public or publics existed after the disaster. So you know how I think in any policy context, when people say, well, we just have to ask the public, or we have to do a public consultation, or we have to survey the public. In a context where everything was destroyed, then you'd have to ask the question, who is the public, right? Who is part of this? And how do we reconstruct the public? And who is not included in our discussion of the public? So what the book tries to do is to precisely explain how disaster-affected communities themselves construct their concept of the public through, I would say, seemingly mundane everyday practices that we often take for granted, but are important to them. So for example, I keep on using the example of a mass grave, but I think it's because it's a powerful example. So when we see families visiting the mass grave of family members who passed away from the typhoon, and they all go there together on the anniversary of the typhoon, we can easily dismiss this as, all right, they're grieving, right? All right, of course, someone died. They'd have to light a candle and pray. But what sets this apart is that when these families come together and see a wreath, like a floral wreath that says justice for disaster survivors, then that's where we transform the mass grave as a site for mourning to a site of politics. It's families demanding to be seen by the world, really, because you've got photographers there, you've got the media there. They're performing their suffering in the public sphere, no longer in the private sphere. It's not private grief. It's not private mourning. It's not a case of them praying to their God, but it's now a case of, hey, guys, look at us. We are suffering here, but look at this wreath that says justice for disaster survivors. And I think that's powerful. That's how we distinguish, or not distinguish, but that's how we can observe something so everyday, something so mundane, something that we can take for granted, but something that tries to say something and get people's attention, because otherwise they will not pay attention to their suffering.
Yeah. Why? Yeah, yeah. That's incredible, because, you know, essentially what you're saying is I don't know, grieving is an act of kind of symbolism and activism as well, which again is kind of like, you know, using this, no, I was going to say anger, but it's the wrong word, like lens of misery. Like, again, I can really see the insight that jumps out of that. And so, yeah, building on, again, with this idea of publics, like, it would be interesting to maybe hear about another maybe kind of key public and also really maybe explore, I'm really kind of interested in this point, how you say that people can be in several publics. There seems to be an overlap. So maybe if you give an example of maybe another one, or, you know, a couple, and how they overlap and what that really means, you know, in practice. Because I think what would be great to hear is, you know, just more of the content of the book, frankly, not just the ideas behind it. Because I think the, you know, the research that you've done and the interviews and the way that you've presented them, that in itself is kind of what speaks most, really, quite apart from the ideas behind it. So, which is more a comment rather than a question. I hate to do that to you at the end.
But... Thank you.
So, yeah, I don't know. So, yeah, anyway, talk to me. Give me what are your thoughts.
So, yeah, you were asking about the kinds of publics that stand out. Of course, the standout public visually, I think, is what I call the contestatory public. So basically, these are activist movements, right? The movement that I studied in particular in that chapter is called People Surge. It's a wordplay on storm surge, and now they're calling it People Surge. I think this kind of public is very relevant in the context of Central Philippines, where activist movements several years before the disasters were just wiped out by a military general that just did arbitrary arrests of people that they considered to be part of a communist movement. And unfortunately, the same scenario is actually happening now with the current president. In fact, the spokesperson of People's Surge was recently arrested with her one-year-old baby by military men because apparently they accused her of harboring weapons, which is obviously not the case. So I think this kind of contestatory public is so important because not just because they are out in the streets protesting, not just because they were able to use... Actually, yeah, they use tropes of misery to make political claims. So, for example, the Philippines is a very Catholic country. So they used, I should know this. I went to a convent school. they performed the Passion of the Christ to demonstrate their own suffering. And I think they did this on a Good Friday or on a Black Saturday or something to that effect. But just drawing that parallelism of how Christ suffered and how they are suffering, to demand government accountability. So that's kind of part of their repertoire, if you want to put it that way. But I think what's important about the contestatory public is that from the beginning, since day one of the disaster, they were the ones who were already asking for government accountability, even when the world tells them to shut up because that's inappropriate, right? And they were able to carry this kind of discourse to this very day, because not all disaster survivors, 6-7 years after the typhoon, not everyone has a house. Not everyone was able to get government support. So I think that's very important. But it's not to say that contestate republics are well celebrated. In fact, they are in very much in tension with what I call collaborative publics. So these are publics or communities that organize themselves to basically collaborate with government to first secure land where they can build climate resilient homes. They're organized by very experienced community organizers. So the mechanism for them, the mechanism for disaster response is not to fight like what the contestate republics did, like not like the, what the activists did, but what they want to happen is to have deliberative processes where citizens themselves decide what should the house look like? How should we collaborate with the government? What livelihood programs do we want? And it's a series of deliberations. And until now, it's ongoing. So I'm going to visit them, 2 weeks from now to present the book and also to just hang out and see how they're doing. But there's an obvious tension there because the collaborative publics will say, we negotiate, we don't fight. They kind of think that the strategy of contestatory publics is very corrosive and it doesn't build trust with the government. Now, I often get asked the question, well, what's a better public? I would say that's a bad question because these publics work well together. It's an example of how vibrant the public sphere looks like in the aftermath of a disaster. There's a range of alternatives for people to articulate the kind of voice that they think best fits their circumstances. So, yeah, there are other examples of publics in the book, but I think these two stand out given their tensions.
Yeah. And it kind of goes back to what you say about these, you know, creative and unexpected ways that tragedy kind of unfolds. And they're actually, right. You know, they're trying to impose, well, I'm not suggesting you're imposing one, but what would be a better public? You can see why that's fundamentally just, not just the wrong question, but an irrelevant question. So, yeah, that's really interesting. And in terms of moving on to, you know, so we've talked about the publics and things like that. And I think we've kind of drilled down into some of those. And I think the surrogate public in particular, as we talked about, is just bloody interesting and not something I'd really considered. You know, like you said, you normally think this kind of behavior is benign. So, yeah. Anyway, I'm talking in circles. But so the book also kind of focuses on like the behaviours that you see emerge as well. So not just the kind of publics that people sit within. So, and you talk about kind of norms and normative behaviours and stuff. So I know we've kind of talked around it, but could you explain again for the more general listener what you kind of mean by norms and normative behaviour, that kind of thing? And again, provides, if it's okay, some of these kind of really rich examples, you know, that you saw. Or were explained to you or observed.
I'll go back to, since you are interested in the surrogate publics. So yeah. I think one of my favorite observations, or not observations, but point of reflection in the field is the value precisely of compassion. I mean, I was taking a swipe at compassion earlier. But so, for example, if we think of Rihanna as a celebrity humanitarian, who posted on Instagram to challenge her fans to care for the Philippines and donate to UNICEF, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. She's serving a surrogate role for people who could not speak for themselves, right? Because disaster survivors didn't have access to the internet in the first few weeks of the disaster. So it's Rihanna serving as their surrogate and marshalling all her global fan base to donate to the Philippines. Now, some academics critique these kinds of surrogates, celebrity humanitarians, or humanitarians in general, as depoliticized, right? Because humanitarianism could easily collapse to sentimentalism or self-righteousness without any political vision or without any demands for justice. People would say, we need justice, not compassion. So before going to the field, that was very much my view, because of course, that's a very strong democratic argument. But I think the argument that humanitarianism without politics is just vanity didn't fly when I started to get to know my respondents. So when I spent time with poor communities, I realized that they themselves choose not to politicize the disaster or call for justice. This is the case for some, not all communities. So obviously there are different publics because many communities are politicized too. But what's striking for me is that sometimes when we see communities not doing anything political, not joining protests, not voting out the mayor that abandoned them, for example, some of us, like myself, before going to the field, might judge them as politically deficient, actors, right? Like they don't know their political interests. But when I got to learn about their circumstances, when I got to know these respondents better, I realized that part of their strategy for recovery is actually to play nice, to work with the system. Because if you do that, you can secure material gains from a city mayor who values loyalty. Now, I am not in the position to tell them that's not political or that is playing with patronage politics. No, because a lot of it is a product of their everyday decision making. If you have very little resources, if you work in a world with constraints, I think their everyday decisions and how to play politics really, really matters. So I wouldn't judge people who think compassion is enough, helping is enough, and say politics is a more superior form of engagement. I think I would be more wary of that because I think I would be more celebratory of what the people in the community want. And if they say, just help us, don't politicize us, don't be too patronizing. They hate it when someone goes there and tries to radicalize is not the word, but maybe politicize or agitate them. Some of them hate that because they feel like, look, we know our interests. We have our own political strategies here. What we need you to do is to help us because there's no drinking water here or because there's no childcare for my babies to go to so I can go to work. So I think we have to add more nuance to this idea that if you're a humanitarian, you're not necessarily political. There's probably a way of doing humanitarianism while recognizing the political struggles of the communities themselves. And the challenge is to recognize that what they do is political, but we just don't recognize that it is.
So I thought what we might do for around about another 15 minutes or so, if that's okay, I'll just go back to podcasting. So that is all very interesting. And so one of the things I thought the kind of listeners, say, might be interested in, and indeed I'm quite interested in as well, despite reading the book, is some of the kind of peculiar forms and types of democracy that kind of emerge. So we've talked about, I don't know, almost reactions around it, right? So surrogate public sources is a cracking example of that. But what ways did people end up actually influencing the system, you know, through these kind of peculiar democratic actions or maybe deliberative processes? Or you know, did they not? Or did they try it and they didn't really do anything? Because the other thing that I'm curious about is the impact of the president in the Philippines. He's a fairly extreme chap, I think it's fair to say. So I don't know, could you talk through that perhaps? Like, what actually emerged? Did people, you know, influence power structures? And what kind of bearing does the president have on all this subsequently?
Yeah, okay, I need a shot of gin for this. I'd be directly quoting the president. Am I allowed to swear on this podcast?
You can swear, yeah, it's fine. Don't worry about it.
Okay, fantastic. So actually, that's a nice... That when you started asking that question of whether disaster-affected communities did shape anything in politics, the first thing that actually did come to my mind was precisely that, electoral politics. So I was in the field in 2016, May 2016. Mm-hmm. This is the height of the presidential campaign. And it really boggles the mind how people who have experienced tragedy, people who have experienced so much suffering and abandonment, from a disaster that took place 3 years before the election, it boggles the mind why these are the same constituents that would vote a man whose campaign promise is, I will kill all drug addicts. This is a man who literally called for the genocide of addicts. And add to that, this is a man who called his military to shoot female rebels in the vagina, because when they don't have vaginas, they're useless rebels or human beings. He called... the American diplomat, faggot. He called Barack Obama son of a whore. He called Pope Francis also a son of a whore, I think. So anyway, the list continues, and there's lots of similarities between President Duterte and Brazil's Jair Bolsonaro. So it was very puzzling for me. But when I was there doing fieldwork at the time when the elections were happening, I see a very different public. It's not a public that is vindictive. It's not a public that is supporting a manipulative strongman. It's not a public that supports a demagogue. What I saw there was a public that feels that it's their obligation to return the favor to a man who was there at the height of the typhoon when he wasn't even expected to be there in the first place. So when the typhoon happened, President Duterte was mayor of Davao City. It's an island very far from Tacloban, but he was there quietly with no fanfare, helping out disaster survivors. It's a stark contrast to the government in power then. The government in power then actually was globally celebrated for being a champion of open governance. The Philippines was described to be Asia's brightest spot at that time because this government is just all about good governance. So really, it's the poster child for everything that liberal democracy stands for. But in that typhoon, because that government was so obsessed with audits, with making sure that everything was done by procedure, it really delayed the distribution of aid. And a lot of people felt abandoned by that government.
Such a weird consequence of open government, isn't it?
It is, yes. But there's some historical tension between the president then and the local political dynasties running the city then. That's a different story. But I think the main insight I put forward here is that so when then-Mayor Duterte was there during the disaster, he was a stark contrast to other politicians who went there to distribute relief goods, took a selfie, had a press release, and then left. Some of my respondents even criticized these politicians who were there, who put isopropyl alcohol on their hands to cleanse their hands after shaking hands with the poor community. So there's no authenticity with these politicians. Duterte was different. He was there helping, no fanfare, no nothing. The only time he granted media interviews was when he was back in his city where he was mayor. And then, and this is where the cursing starts, when he just said, motherfucker, God must have been elsewhere when the disaster happened. And this is really just, I think, the best example of how his dark charisma works. He's very gangster, he's very badass, he's OG, as kids would call it today. He saw a man who was there, who was both doing something and expressing compassion. So at the height of the campaign, it was insane. So I was in a remittance center. I told you earlier about overseas Filipino workers. 10% of the population works overseas. Around March is the time when these workers send money back to the Philippines because it's graduation season, so it's time for parties. But in this occasion, they were sending money back to support President Duterte's campaign. They would print banners that they can hang outside their houses and say, for example, Curato family supports President Duterte. I mean, my family didn't do that, but it's typical. Typically, elections in the Philippines are defined by guns, goons, golds, and now gigabytes because of disinformation. And typically, when a campaign rally happens, people are paid to wear the campaign T-shirts of the politicians. It's typical. That happens. It's an expectation. But with President Duterte, the poor communities, middle-class communities, people who literally lost everything 3 years ago, spent their money printing their own T-shirts. So it's all personalized. I saw this in an internet cafe where teenagers are using PowerPoint to lay out a T-shirt logo to support the president. And so I thought,
Obviously, that speaks powerfully of, political movement or whatever, but it is also lame on behalf of these teenagers.
They should be doing something else. But actually, there's a youth fan base of the president as well. So I think all of these kind of just say that this is not demagoguery. This is not manipulation. There are accusations of Cambridge Analytica also using the Philippines as laboratory for disinformation, and there is some credible evidence just proves that. But I would also say that to reduce the electoral victory of this president to disinformation just ignores the authenticity of the populist publics that supported this president to power. So in the book, and this is the hardest chapter to write, because I need to understand why the people that I've known for 3 or 2 years are the same people who would elect a morally reprehensible man. And what I understand from my conversations with them is that, look, it's our obligation to help him. He was there for us when no one else was here for us. I remember in one of the anniversaries of the typhoon, again, the scene was a mass grave. The president, so I was there with some disaster survivors and some community groups. The president arrived for a speech. The vice president, who Philippines has a weird system, the vice president and the president are elected separately. So in effect now, the vice president is the de facto head of opposition. Anyway, so the vice president is there as well. She's a woman, and the president just had a speech, and he said something about ogling the vice president's legs, like her legs are super smooth or something. And the crowd laughed, and I felt so uncomfortable. So, of course, and I didn't laugh. I mean, of course, I wouldn't laugh. I felt like if this were Hitler, I'd be the person who wouldn't be doing the salute, right? I was so self-righteous. So when I told the person beside me, oh my God, that's so crass, the person just said, well, he cared enough to be here, which is so powerful, I think, because not all politicians cared enough to be there. So some people would say, why is the bar so low, right? Being there is good enough. But if we understand this from deeper histories of injury, deeper histories of frustration, then it's so meaningful for a president to be there on the anniversary of the typhoon and to tell disaster survivors that, look, help is coming. You will have houses by December. And true enough, I went back there a few months after the president's speech. Yep, houses were there. They were not perfect, but they were there. So I think this is the political consequence of that disaster, that the city that considered themselves to have been abandoned suddenly was a political player, suddenly was able to make a political statement in a tightly contested electoral race.
Yeah. And it, you know, it speaks so powerfully of, like, well, I think, you know, the, obviously the central tenet of the book, you know, when people are so miserable or experience such misery, you know, if someone's there, he's gonna help to relieve that, then naturally you're gonna latch onto it. And it, yeah, I don't know. Anyway, that's fascinating. And I think you've given, you know, like an amazing range of examples of some of the things like you've discovered and the publics that emerged and the kind of associated behaviours. So I suppose to summarise perhaps, or I don't know, to apply it, I suppose, you know, we're only going to see more natural disasters in the world, like perhaps in Australia, there's a bit of scepticism around climate change, but I think in most parts of the world, it's an established kind of fact these days, you know. So what can we learn from your research? And, you know, what possibly it's a two-part question, you know, what do you think we'll see emerge as more disasters occur in other parts of the world? And you know, what do our public institutions need to do to prepare for that? Specifically in the context of, obviously, democratic participation and so on. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about flood defences here. I wouldn't ask you that.
I think one of the strongest messages of the book is the need for decision makers, whether we're talking about humanitarian organizations, state actors, community organizers, to be more sensitive in terms of how politics is performed. I mean, in the aftermath of a disaster or any tragedy for that matter, performance of politics will not always be what people say. Typically, it's what people do, or typically it's what people say behind the scenes. So I think we have to develop better mechanisms to understand the pulse of people who are suffering beyond the usual tools that we are used to. So the book kind of talks about that in every chapter in terms of what people are trying to communicate or express, but we just have no tools to appreciate or receive or process. So I think that is the message that the book wants to put forward in terms of a more action-oriented, perspective, which is to say we need mechanisms of better listening. We need mechanisms of better reception. But we also, and I think this is just the last big point I want to put forward, is that but we also have to recognize that yes, communities are experiencing misery and we have to bestow recognition to that misery, but let's not forget that there are also hierarchies of misery, meaning the typhoon survivors got a lot of attention because they were the ideal victim, because the world saw them as people deserving of compassion. But why is there not a similar movement globally to farmers who are dying because of drought? Why is there not a similar sense of compassion in the Philippines with the widows of the drug war that the president launched, and now there are 20,000 people dead. So misery is important to mobilize political action, but I also recognize that misery has hierarchies. Misery also enforces different forms of inequalities. And I think the challenge for any practitioner or even just an observer of global events is for us to always think about, why are we prioritizing some forms of misery over other forms of misery? What is our decision-making criteria to say that these people deserve our help and those people don't? And I think that's a challenge that I just want to put out there, because there's not an easy question. I've tried to settle that in the book, but I didn't. And I think it's inherent. The tension in that question is inherent. You really can't answer that because it can't be an oppression Olympics, right? It's always a sense of how can we justify helping others but not others. So that is a tension that will always be there. And I think the best response we can have is to strengthen mechanisms for accountability. We will make mistakes, right? We will prioritize some forms of suffering over others. That's just a fact. We have scarce resources. We have scarce emotional capital to deal with them. But we need to be able to hold each other accountable for the misery of others as well.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, you really, not to be flippant about such important kind of subject material, but you really do have a great way of kind of summarizing things, I think. But yeah, hierarchies of misery is certainly like quite a powerful concept, I suppose, to emerge from the book. And again, not to sound like an endless broken record, but really something I hadn't considered, you know, a classification of misery indeed. Like,
why is your meltdown in the UK worse than the meltdown in the US, right? I mean, they're both meltdowns.
Yeah. And I suppose, well, I suppose that, I mean, that's the kind of broader point. I suppose I haven't really thought about why it would be useful to classify misery, you know, particularly in a UK perspective. I mean, it does not compare to a natural disaster. I do not mean to make that comparison, but certainly comparing with the US.
Anyway,
but you know, there is almost this temptation to compare the US with the UK at the moment, and you can absolutely see why, and like I'd be tempted to, but it does lead you to quite a miserable thought process, and like, you know, it's best not to get bogged down. Whereas what this neatly demonstrates is, you know, through this lens, actually there is powerful insight in misery and in examining misery and the implications of such, which is, you know, which is great. Okay, cool. Well, so I think we should probably kind of wrap it up there, because I think that's a really great sojourn through, you know, the book itself and why you did it and some of the things that you learned as well. And like, I really appreciate that you've kind of broken it down for like quite a good kind of public audience, if you will, as well, which really isn't actually that easy to do. So yeah, good work. So the book itself then, a bit of naked plug-in. Well, you know, thanks for coming on. So the book itself, it's called Democracy in a Time of Misery, From Spectacular Tragedies to Deliberative Action. It's 2019, and it's Oxford University Press. And naturally, you can just kind of Google that if you want to pick up a copy, and I would suggest that you do. How do people kind of get hold of a copy? Where do you actually buy these sorts of books, Nicole?
So Oxford University Press's website sells it. I checked in Book Depository, Amazon, it's there. I recognize the cost is extortionate, such as the case of academic books. Maybe demand Oxford University Press, troll them on Twitter to release a paperback. Maybe it's a collective action problem.
Okay, we need a paperback. Okay,
we need a paperback.
But anyway, what I would say, yeah, it is worth every penny, because it is, it's a good read. And like I've said many times, it does offer a very unique perspective. And I've read quite a lot of stuff about democracy and heard lots of people talk about democracy. And, you know, it's difficult to get excited about it, but it's rare to find new ways of looking at it. So, yeah, it's refreshing. So just to end then... Well, yeah, any shout-outs, you know, I like to end on a few shout-outs. So, you know, for one thing, can people follow you on Twitter and things like that? Do you do much public speaking where people might be able to check you out? And yeah, any shout-outs, you know, because, I mean, there is an acknowledgement section that's nearly as long as the book itself. So I don't know if you want to mention anyone that helps with this.
But, yeah, I was ready to give you like emotional reading of the acknowledgement section.
Well, I thought I'd have a shifty. So, So yeah, I don't know. Anyway, shout outs and where can people follow you and hear from you and stuff? Go mad.
Yes, I think the only shout out I will single out tonight, obviously, are for my respondents. They probably will not listen to this podcast, but it's really just driving the point home that this book is not possible without the generosity of these communities' time in making this research possible. But yeah, just in terms of staying in touch, I am quite active on Twitter. So any form of engagement is welcome. I'm quite used to trolling as well. So that's also fine. Oh. That's what people are up to these days.
Okay. Okay. Well, that's good of you. So what you're saying is you're actively encouraging trolling. So yeah. Okay.
That's the message.
No, I'm sure, you know, of the 25 people who listen to this, I'm sure a few of them will say something on Twitter. So we'll see. Okay, well, it only served to say thank you very much for your time. It's very much appreciated. And we'll end it there.
All right. Thanks, Ben.
Well, there we go. There's another episode of the Practical Democracy podcast all wrapped up. It was certainly a belter this time. You can find Nicole on Twitter, at Nicole Curato, all one word. And we'll share a link in the description so you can purchase a copy of her book, which I'd really recommend doing. See you soon for another episode, and in the meantime, take care of yourself.